Quality Improvement and Patient Protection Committee doing a listening session on out-of-network billing. This is an opportunity for us to hear more about the dimensions of this issue. On April 6th, we heard from the insurance carriers, and today is an opportunity to hear from providers. It's not a public hearing, but really just an informal opportunity for us to understand how this issue impacts folks in the Commonwealth. If you'd like to offer comments today, please be sure to sign up. There's a sign-up sheet just outside the door. If you previously notified HPC staff that you wanted to provide comments, you're already on the list. I will call up an individual or a panel of speakers to the table here in front to provide comments. Please keep your comments relatively brief. We have 10 speakers, so if everyone took 5 minutes, we'll be here way over our time, so we want to try to keep it as brief as possible and succinct, so we have time for everyone wishing to provide comments to do so. Commissioners and or HPC staff may have questions, which we will try to hold until you have finished speaking. And time permitting, we will ask if anyone else in attendance would like to provide comments at the end of the session. I hope folks have read the policy brief on out-of-network billing that was issued by the commission earlier. And I will turn it over to Lois to do some introductory comments before we hear from our first panel of speakers.
Thank you, Commissioner. And as you've mentioned, today's session is indeed in further follow-up to the Health Policy Commission's policy brief on out-of-network billing, which we issued earlier this year. And in that brief, we outlined concerns regarding emergency and surprise out-of-network billing scenarios, and also described some of the leading policy strategies that have been implemented in other states. And as this slide shows, some of those policy solutions include increased disclosure and transparency for consumers about to prevent out-of-network billing issues from arising. Second, hold harmless provisions and balance billing provisions which seek to remove the patient from having to be in the middle of a payment dispute. And third, mechanisms to determine the appropriate amount of payment for out-of-network provider services, both in terms of we've seen strategies of establishing a standard level of payment, as well as dispute resolution mechanisms where an agreement can be reached. And as we, as the brief describes, we go into detail in the New York law, which is, as far as we're aware, the most comprehensive statute addressing each of these three solution areas. We did hold our first listening session on April 6th, where we provided an opportunity to hear from market participants on this issue. At that meeting, we did hear both from health plans and consumer advocacy groups. And at that meeting, certainly concerns from consumers that this, in fact, does occur. We heard some examples of situations where patients were, in fact, billed for services where they weren't aware and couldn't be aware that the provider that they saw or the lab that they're where their doctor referred them was out of network, and the concerns that affect patients in those scenarios. The health plans, we heard from a number of plans in the MAP Association as well as Blue Cross Blue Shield. And those plans were mainly in agreement that for them it's important to address this issue comprehensively, especially with solutions around determination of the appropriate payment amount at an appropriate level. We pressed the carriers for information about sort of the extent and magnitude of the problem, which is it's something that we've been challenged as a staff to identify. We've heard anecdotes, and we've done our best to do research about the extent to which consumers are facing this issue and get a sense of the dollar amount. And one health plan in particular identified for them in a year, in 2011, $134 million in out-of-network costs. And it's something that an issue that we're continuing to refine. We heard in particular when pressed about the types of providers who may be involved in these situations, the carriers identified the EWAP providers or emergency physicians, radiologists, anesthesiologists, and pathology, as well as ambulance providers and some labs. And so with that, the commissioners were very interested in having further information and hearing directly from providers, which brings us to today as we seek more information from the experience of providers in these various specialties and in these various settings, as well as from hospitals, about the to the extent that we can get more information about the extent of the problem and how it affects plans, providers, and their patients. So with that, we can begin with our first panel, unless the commissioners have any further remarks.
Okay. Our first panel is the Mass Hospital Association, Mike Brzezinski and Karen Granoff. And again, please keep the comments to 5 minutes or less.
Thank you. Sorry we were unable to join you at the last session, but we have had a number of follow-up conversations with Lois and staff around this issue. For the record, my name is Mike Brzezinski. I am Vice President of Government Advocacy for the Massachusetts Hospital Association. Joining me is Karen Granoff. She's Senior Director of Managed Care for the Association and certainly the expert on this issue from our perspective, so I'll be very brief before I hand it over to her. At the outset, I just want to say MHA fully believes that patients and their families should have protection from any undue financial burdens resulting from surprise billing. In this instance, I'm talking about the bills for services rendered by a non-participating physician at a participating or in-network hospital. We hope to work with the HPC on identifying opportunities for transparency and disclosure, as well as the development of dispute resolution processes that might help protect patients from getting stuck in the middle of such circumstances. However, we also believe it's essential to gain better data on this issue in order to understand its scope and prevalence here in the Commonwealth amongst the full panoply of out-of-network issues. And I think it's clear, as Lois noted, that we currently have a lack of actionable public data on this issue. We believe much helpful and needed data is available from the state's insurance industry, and in recent communication with the HPC, we highlighted a number of key questions that, when answered, we think will help establish a fuller perspective of the challenges at hand. To help better inform our own understanding of this issue as it relates to hospitals, we also conducted a survey of our membership over the past few weeks. Karen's going to provide an overview of the survey results, as well as discuss further some of the complexities related to this.
I will also note that prior to coming to MHA...
Do you want to speak more into the microphone, please?
Prior to coming to MHA, I was the first director of the Office of Patient Protection for 7 years and therefore very familiar with the types of issues that come up between consumers, providers, and payers. As Mike said, we completely agree that surprise billing is something we do not want to see happen. Some of the recommendations by the HPC that remove the patient from the middle of it, and offer a dispute resolution process, additional disclosure and transparency are definitely things that we would like to work with the HPC on over time. But we're also concerned that the data that's being used, or the lack of data, I should say, may misrepresent what the magnitude of the actual problem is. People need to understand that when you say out-of-network, there's lots of reasons that patients end up in out-of-network situations. Sometimes it's pure choice by the patient. Maybe someone using an out-of-network component of a PPO. We've all been in a situation where we're traveling out of state and you get sick or injured and you end up in an out-of-network hospital or doctor's office. And then there's the issue of ambulance transportation. That's a big component of that. Another complicating factor that has to be taken into account is the proliferation of narrow network products. In these situations, there are hospitals and doctors who may only participate in a small number of health plan products. Sometimes they're deliberately excluded by the health plan. Patients may find that even their local hospital may not be part of the plan that they are enrolled in. And so the more plans promote these products and the more they're promoted on the exchange, the more you're going to wind up with out-of-network situations. So again, that's something that has to be taken into consideration. The HPC, in their report, noted that there is a lack of data on this in Massachusetts. And while we don't disagree that there is situations of surprise billing in the state, we really need to get a better handle on the magnitude. We do not feel it's appropriate to rely on data from states like Texas, where, and I'll quote from the article that was cited in the HPC paper, the three insurers with the largest market share reported that 41 to 68% of dollars billed for ED physician care at in-network hospitals were submitted by out-of-network emergency docs. We do not believe and have not seen any evidence that Massachusetts has a comparable situation. And that brings me to the Blue Cross number that was cited last month, where they said $134 million in out-of-network services. How much of that was ambulance? How much of that was true surprise billing? How much of that was patients out of the area seeking services? Until we have a breakdown of that, that's a misguided number to use. It misrepresents the magnitude of the problem. And as Mike said, we did send a letter to the HPC last month requesting that they get much more data from the carriers showing what the magnitude of the problem is and where the problem lies. Are we talking about 80% of patients are going to emergency rooms and getting billed? If so, that's a big problem. Are we talking about 2%? You know, what? Where? And is it because of narrow networks? Is it because doctors are charging and balance billing patients? And just because docs are not in network, we also don't have evidence that they're balance billing patients for this. So again, we need to get more data. We wanted to find out what the situation is among hospitals, and so we did survey all of our acute care member hospitals, and we received responses from about 21 hospitals. We learned that hospitals contract with anywhere from 13 to as many as 60 different health plans and products. And even within a particular health plan, they don't always contract with every line of business. And even that's even true among Blue Cross, the largest carrier in the state. Not every hospital contracts with every product that Blue Cross offers. And we'll give you some information that we put together that shows the charts, but it's very difficult when you think about that to have a one-to-one match for every doctor that might be providing services within your hospital. We also learned that about 78% of the hospitals that responded do outsource care to one or more of the ERAP specialties. Some hospitals indicated they do also have outside contracts with things like oncology, pain medicine, behavioral health, things like that. And we'll show you the chart that shows the breakdown among the different specialties. The majority of hospitals that responded indicated that they do use best efforts and strive to get a match among at least the major carriers that provide services within their hospital. If they have risk arrangements with any of the health plans, they're pretty much required to have the same carrier contract for all of their specialty groups. And they're working hard to either update contracts or to try to move towards getting as many physicians as possible in the same contracts. But there are challenges that are faced as a result. If they're going to recruit these specialties to the hospital, have them as employed docs, then they have to subsidize the practices, which is expensive. There's often few alternatives for community or more rural hospitals. There's sometimes low reimbursement rates might be an issue for certain specialties. It's difficult to find physicians to take call for some of these things. And they will request a premium if they're going to be taking call. And it's also important to remember that just because a doctor might be out of network, not mean 100% of the time they're balance billing patients for the services they provide. They will often accept or negotiate with the carrier and accept what the carrier is paying. As I said, the limited networks, our members agreed that has absolutely, without a doubt, exacerbated the problem. And one of the complicating factors that we've heard from our members is that the hospital will almost always get paid for the services if they're providing emergency services. The physicians sometimes just get outright denied as being out of network, even though they're providing the services to the members of that health plan. So not only will they not get paid what the health plan rate is, they just will get denied completely for the services rendered. So that's another issue. There's a lot of variation in how often hospitals even learn about surprise bills. The bills don't come from the hospital, so patients don't always think to call the hospital. When they do hear about it, they will take steps to try to either work with the provider or contact the health plan to try to get some sort of resolution to the situation. The hospitals will also try to do things in terms of member education or patient education as part of the admission package or prior to the admission. They all agree that there can be more education done, and I don't think they would be opposed to some of the disclosure measures that we talked about that other states are doing. So just in terms of, you know, summary, we would like to see additional data from insurers. We agree that there should be protection from surprise bills. We have urged the Health Policy Commission to look at the NAIC, the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, and their Health Benefit Plan Network Access and Adequacy Model Act that was just recently passed or approved, I should say, last November, requires insurers to have a process in place to ensure that covered benefits can be accessed at the in-network level from non-participating providers if the insurer's network is insufficient. It requires insurers to establish a program for payment of out-of-network physician bills, includes a provider mediation process, and it has a lot of what we think are somewhat meaningful steps that might offer some guidance. Solutions increasing transparency are all good ideas. We don't oppose them by any means, but at the same time, once you're in the hospital, a disclosure is not going to mean anything. You know, you're not going to decide at that point, I'm not going to have the surgery because the anesthesiologist isn't in network. So it's a step in the right direction, but not necessarily a resolution. So we are happy to take any questions, and we're happy to continue to work with all of you.
Thank you. If you could provide the written testimony of the Lois, that would be great. Any questions of the panel?
Maybe I'll start off with a question. So I want to take the simplest circumstance, which is not where an entire hospital is out of network, but where a hospital is in network, but some of the providers are out of network. So maybe the hospital is in network and the emergency physicians are not in network. And I know on a helpful page that we were provided that occurs at least four times in the Commonwealth. Is it fair to consumers that they go to a hospital that's in network and the emergency physician is not?
So the doc may not be in network. Mm-hmm. We don't know that the doctor is charged, whether there's a balance bill, what the health plan is paying, and that's why we're asking for more data. We do not think the patient should be put in the middle of it, if that's what you're asking.
So you would support then if we made a recommendation to the legislature that said that if a hospital is in network for its emergency services, the physicians who see that patient must accept in-network rates. But then how else are you going to solve it?
Well, we're saying we need to have more data.
Suppose it's three patients. Is it okay for three patients to be charged many thousands of dollars?
We have a dispute resolution process.
Why would you
inflict such a significant change in policy for three patients in the entire Commonwealth of Massachusetts?
Why should a patient have to figure out why if their emergency physician is in network? Even if they figured out whether the hospital is in network in an emergency, why should they have to figure out?
Do you have data that shows the prevalence of that?
Well, I have at least four seemingly big medical groups, emergency groups. There are at least two pathology groups. There are at least two radiology groups. There are at least nine anesthesia groups that are on this list.
I don't know what list you're talking about, but in any
case, it was a list that was largely provided to us by the insurers when we asked for it. And they seem like they're big. That is, I've heard of all of them and so on.
We're not going to speak for the doctors.
So I don't understand. So the easiest way to get the patient out of the middle is just to say, if you go to an in-network facility for some form of emergency services, the physicians have to be paid in-network.
And then wouldn't you be driving all physician organizations to be hospital employees at that point in time?
No, you could say, look, you don't have to be. You don't have to be. But if you work at that hospital and that hospital is in network, there's an expectation that you will get paid an in network rate.
That it is not that.
I don't understand why that's not a viable solution. Why is that not a viable solution?
Doctor, they're independent practices. You can't.
Just make it incumbent. Just say, look.
Karen noted that hospitals can contract with up to 60 different plans and products within those plans. So this requires...
But that could be a rule on the contracting.
It could also be a rule on the carrier, because the carriers sometimes don't want them in the network. That's a carrier issue as well.
Okay, so then we could say, look, so it could be a rule which is you either have to agree to it or the hospital can't be in network.
Maybe you require insurers to recognize those docs as being in network in that situation. Why does the pendulum swing in this direction on this particular
issue? That's fine. The docs have to accept the in-network fee.
I would think that as an economist, you would want to see more data to understand what the magnitude of the problem is.
I was once told by someone named Don Berwick that any medical error was too many. And it didn't really matter how many there were. One medical error was too many.
But you don't make policy based
and
on
I had,
your
The request for more data, I don't quite understand it. So let's say it's infrequent would be one possibility, and another that it's very frequent would be the other possibility. Let's just take those two cases. What would you do to fix it if it's infrequent?
Certainly if it's infrequent, things like dispute resolution processes, like they set up in New York, are excellent resolutions. If it's frequent, that's a different thing. We have no evidence that shows that it's frequent.
What would you support in policy if it were frequent?
I don't know. I would have to see what the data is, and I'm not going to make a
statement. But if you're going to see what the data is, what I'm asking is how
I can tell you that in 7 years as the director of the Office of Patient Protection, I don't recall seeing cases for in-state patients. I do recall seeing it for patients out of state who got huge balance bills for kids.
Can I ask one other question? Let's say if it's infrequent, why is the requirement onerous? Because it only applies to very few cases.
I'm sorry?
If the surprise billing were infrequent, mm-hmm. why would the requirement that the physician accept the in-network payment be onerous? It's not onerous if it's infrequent.
You'd be stipulating that they have to accept specific contract items from up to 60 different payers?
If it was infrequent,
doesn't that seem like somewhat
of
a severe
step?
There may
also be, if you think about the payers that contract with physicians and hospitals, some of them are very small, they don't have a big presence. Some of it is, as I said, the narrow network situation. There's a lot of complexities there. Getting hospitals and practices to have the whole one-to-one match is a difficult thing to achieve.
And we're not saying no to any of this. We're just saying let's get full picture of what's going on. We have anecdotal information, admittedly.
But I thought your answer to Don was that it didn't really matter whether it was frequent or not, because your solution didn't really change whether it was frequent or not.
We prefer to rely on data and evidence to determine what the answer should be. If it's a significant issue, then yes, maybe it's a stronger policy step that needs to be taken in this situation.
We're not saying that there should be. If we find out from data, Blue Cross comes up with numbers that show 60% of our members are getting thousands of dollars in out-of-network bills when they're treated in network hospital, that's a problem. But we don't know that.
I'm going to move us along due to the time issue, but thank you for the testimony.
Thank you.
From the Mass Medical Society, Brendan Abel.
Good morning. Thank you to all of you commissioners for convening this discussion today. My name is Brendan Abel from the Mass Medical Society. And we are happy to be here to engage in this conversation on this important issue. Upon receiving the invitation from Lois, began, especially given the time of the year, we didn't have any formal meetings of our Committee on Legislation, I did the next best thing, which is to catch as many physicians in the halls as you can and start raising this issue. And asking them about their thoughts on this. And I was shocked by a rather rare occurrence. And that was a common twofold answer. And that was, one, that this issue is incredibly complex. It seemed that each position that I discussed kind of brought into this another level, another consideration that we had not thought of. And second, that regardless of the complexity, this is most important, the patient currently loses, and that needs to change. So with those important points in mind, I'll provide a few more thoughts on behalf of the Medical Society. First,
and this echoes the Hospital Association, more and better data is needed to better understand the scope and the nature of the problem. We heard from a previous meeting a figure from Blue Cross about the amount of out-of-network care provided. But there are many questions that immediately came to mind. What degree was this intentional versus unintentional? How much was out-of-state versus in-state or truly surprise billing? What degree that physicians were out-of-network, that were out-of-network or in-network for some products of Blue Cross or other carriers, but did not happen to be for the specific plan of the patient that received the out-of-network bill? And, of course, what is the experience of other insurers in the state? The Medical Society believes that drilling down on this preliminary data to answer these and other questions would be immensely helpful to inform discussions about policy solutions. Second, as I mentioned, this issue is quite complex. In discussions with physicians and specialty organizations, some of which are here today, the complexities have been raised that include instances where physician organizations are, again, in network for the vast majority of health plans in Massachusetts but do not have negotiated contracts with smaller or more geographically isolated plans. And I think that was underscored by a survey from the Hospital Association, which indicated some hospitals contracted with 60 health plans. We also heard sometimes there were national plans with a smaller presence in the Commonwealth. And sometimes physician organizations have negotiated a contract with a major insurer, but have not done so for every product offered by a specific insurer, and this could be an issue as well. And certain trends, as the Hospital Association indicated, exacerbate each of these issues, including the promotion of limited network plans. While these plans may reduce expenses on one end, they also may increase the frequency of out-of-network situations because of limited availability of in-network providers. And third, we, as I said at the outset, we want to see an elimination of surprise billing to patients. For certain circumstances, improvements in transparency would be incredibly helpful. We would welcome discussions about transparency policies that could truly help reduce surprise billing, but in other instances, we would welcome a further discussion about policies that take the patient out. These policy discussions need to occur with a balanced approach of the many issues at play when providers and physician organizations negotiate contracts. While we agree that the, quote, ERAP physician organizations should participate in as many products as possible that are covered by the hospital, the nature of contract negotiation can at times lead to gaps. While the Medical Society hopes that the transparency policies could reduce this occurrence and that other policies could, again, take the patient out of the middle, we feel that it is important to ensure that an environment is maintained to allow for balanced market negotiations as well. I'm happy to be joined here by representatives from the emergency physician group, the radiologists, the pathologists, who also may be able to offer some further insight on this issue.
Yeah, thank you. Any questions for Brent?
So I'm going to push on the same theme. I don't believe this is either complex or in need of a balanced approach. Okay. When a patient goes to an in-network provider, it should be the case that all of the services provided by that in-network provider are in-network. So if they choose to go to an in-network hospital, I do not understand why they should have to ask if the emergency physician is in-network, and if not, pay a higher price. That doesn't strike me as complex, and it doesn't strike me as a balanced approach where we have some dispute resolution over whether the patient should have called in the ambulance on the way there. So the lack of difficulty, it seems to me it's not difficult because you just have to set a maximum price that the physicians receive. And you say if you don't have a contract, then some next appropriate contract. But I fail to see why this is either complex or we need some kind of balanced, negotiated approach for this.
So I would make 2 points. The first is that I think the portion of your question that referred to the higher price is one that we think may be presumptive and that we don't know that just because a patient is receiving out-of-network care is necessarily a quote higher price. So
then imposing a price limit won't affect them. So that's not an argument not to do it.
And the second point is, again, that from the perspective of the physician organization that is contracting, I'm trying to ensure that you have all products covered with all plans, which could be up to 60 at any given time, to me, offers complexity.
Just say the maximum you can get is the maximum price you have from that insurer, if they've got other contracts with the insurer.
So I would say the medical society would be welcome to engage in discussions about those types of policies, but we'd have to come.
But I don't want to bury this under 3 years of study. There's nothing that's going to be gained by saying we need a balanced approach and we need to study it, we need to understand the extent of it. If the patients are not being charged, it doesn't matter if you impose something. If they are being charged way up there, then it's beneficial to them. No patient should have to be responsible for that.
Well, I would say
it's
that
not that complex.
That we think that we would support a balanced approach and we would also...
What does balanced mean?
It means one that is looking at the various moving parts and is that ensuring that physicians still have the opportunity to negotiate in good faith with
Does a balanced approach mean that a patient never has to pay more than an in-network amount for a doctor if they go to an in-network facility? Does that fall under balanced for you?
It's very interesting. I think that would be a wonderful goal. For
Brendan. Thank you.
Next, we have the Mass Radiological Society. That's Dr. Philip Rogoff and Dr. James Bezerra. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for hearing us. My name is Philip Rogoff. Can everybody hear me? I don't have a loud voice. I am a radiologist at Mount Auburn Hospital in Cambridge. I have been there since 1985. I'm also the immediate past president of the Massachusetts Radiological Society, and I have been chair of the Managed Care Committee for the Mass Radiological Society for about 15 years. I'm going to speak from two perspectives. One is from the perspective of the Mass Radiological Society, and second, my own personal feelings about this matter. I can't say they are divergent, but I cannot speak for an entire society. I can speak for what the general consensus is of the Massachusetts Radiological Society Executive Committee, but I can't speak for all of its members. I have data on my own practice, and we are independent of Mount Auburn Hospital. We're not Mount Auburn Hospital employees, we are independent. I do have some data on my own practice, which may or may not reflect what Mount Auburn Hospital is, and I can't speak to what the issues are at Mount Auburn Hospital. Now, we are on staff at Mount Auburn, and it is the only facility that we're on staff at. Our contracts are negotiated primarily through Mount Auburn Cambridge IPA. So most of our contracts run through the IPA, and those contracts are negotiated by the IPA and the hospital on behalf of the physicians and the hospital. And the hospital has about 50% of its physicians that are employed, the remainder are independent. So the billing practices are going to vary depending on what the physicians are. We do have independent contracts that are separate from a hospital, but as far as I'm aware, pretty much everything that we need to cover, we do cover. That does not mean that we don't get out-of-network billing, because we do. The issue with the out-of-network billing is it's either out-of-state, or there are times it's related to the narrow networks. And what I mean by the narrow networks are there are occasions where there are self-insured entities that have somewhat narrow networks with respect to who the providers are. We may or may not fall into the category of within that narrow network. And I would have no way of knowing that a Blue Cross patient who comes to Mount Auburn is not supposed to be at Mount Auburn because the narrow network defines it needs to be, so that patient needs to be somewhere else. That would fall into the category of out-of-network billing for us. I have looked at our own data, and of our data for the last 12 months, we had 0.8% of our bills that would have fallen into the out-of-network category. Of that 0.8%, the vast majority were resolved, and I'm sure there was some discomfort that was translated to the patient, because there is a patient in the middle of this. But of that 0.8%, there were a total of 8 bills of the entire amount, and that reflects that out of almost 200,000. Where the patient really ended up being in the middle of this. The collection for those bills, the median, was $57. for those 8 bills. And frankly, and this is my opinion, this does not reflect the opinion of my colleagues in the MRS, because I don't know what their opinions are. I think 8 is too much. I tend to agree that I don't think the patient should be in the middle of this. But at the same time, I do believe that there needs to be a system that we ultimately end up with that is fair to everybody, primarily to the patient. It also needs to be fair to the health plans, it needs to be fair to the physicians. Because from the perspective of the physicians, if we don't end up with something that is negotiated and fair with respect to reimbursement for a service provided, and the physicians feel that it isn't fair, that's going to encourage more physicians to be out of network. That's not really what the actual goal here needs to be. We need to have everybody in network, and the payments need to be reflected in such a way that would encourage physicians to remain in network and not go out of network. Because it doesn't occur to a large extent in this state the way it does elsewhere in the country, but there are physicians who don't participate in health plans because they don't like the contracts. I mean, that's just the reality. We don't want to exacerbate that problem. I just think that would be a mistake.
Thank you. Dr. Bezra.
Good morning. My name is Jim Bezra. I am a radiologist at South Shore Hospital. I'm the treasurer of South Shore Radiology Associates, and I'm also a remote past president of Mass Radiologic Society, and currently president of the South Shore Physicians Organization, which is the physician arm of the South Shore PHO. I would say that I agree with most of what's been said from this end. I would just like to further add that I think that characterizing the issue as predominantly that of the hospital-based physicians may well be a mischaracterization, and I think that looking at data would help to show that. At my hospital, the radiology group, the anesthesia group, the pathology group, and the emergency physician group are all part of the PHO, and as such, we are all highly aligned with the hospital, and all our major contracts are together with the hospital, so that the out-of-network issue is really negligible, same order of magnitude as with Phil. Having said that, I would just like to add that, well, that there are out-of-network issues that are sometimes patient-generated. They tend to not be in the emergency setting. They tend to be patients who are seeing some of our PHO docs, decide to have an elective procedure, get referred to an in-network provider, and then decide, because this is Boston, because we have lots of choices here, that they're going to go somewhere else. And that's a source of a problem for the PHO, because that goes to our budget. So that's an issue for us. But I think that the common thread is that of transparency, and that when patients do go out of network in an elective situation, I think transparency can help that problem. In the emergency setting, I agree that it's probably going to be less useful. And just to go back to a question that was asked earlier about, well, what if we just made the number the number? And to that, I would just say that as physicians who occasionally have the ability to negotiate contracts, whether or not you participate in a network is really the only leverage you have. So to basically take the network number out of that equation deprives physicians of any ability to negotiate any type of differentiation between groups. And I thought that we were supposed to be talking about value-based reimbursement and the ability to differentiate oneself as a provider. And I think that to take the sledgehammer approach and just put a cap on everything works against that philosophy.
Thank you. Questions for the panel?
Do the two of you agree with the Mass Medical Society that if a patient, what I just heard Brendan, I think, agree to, if a patient goes to an in-network facility, that the physicians that they see at the in-network facility should be in-network to them?
I mean, the answer to that is yes, I do think that should be the case. And I think the vast majority of physicians, and I'm aware of certainly our institution, are in-network. But that doesn't mean that the contract that the patient has is going to be an in-network contract. So it's a simple answer, but it's a complex problem.
So the answer is no, you don't agree that.
I
couldn't tell whether your answer was yes, you agree.
I agree that physicians should be in network, but that's not a guarantee that there aren't going to be issues without a network bill because of the narrow network issue.
Functionally, for me, it doesn't matter because we're participating and it's not really a problem.
But the bill they get may be a big problem.
And one of the problems here, one of the questions that you ask here about the biggest challenges with respect to out-of-network billing scenarios is that when a patient presents, there is really no way for a provider to know in real time what that patient's coverage is because these things are in a constant state of flux. So we may be billing somebody out-of-network and not even know. It's probably more often than not the case, at least for hospital-based physicians who don't have boots on the ground billing people, which we don't.
But I'm trying to get a sense to the answer. So I thought Brendan at the end said, yes, he would support some solution that meant that if you went to an in-network provider, all the providers associated with that care should be in network. Now Brendan's saying that he did not mean to agree to that.
We took that as a yes.
I'm sorry. I think that the medical society wants to see as many physicians, wants to see that number as high as possible. But a requirement does not make sense, and the medical society does not support it. So I'm sorry if I was unclear.
Dr. Sankin.
Thank you.
Next, we have the Mass College of Emergency Physicians, Dr. Eli Berg and Greg Broderick.
Eli Berg, I'm a practicing emergency physician at Hallmark Health, past president of the Mass College of Emergency Physicians, and we're the champions of the Mass College of Emergency Physicians. With me is Mr. Greg Broderick, and we're here on behalf of the Mass College of Emergency Physicians. If anyone hear me, I apologize for my voice this morning. Thank you for your interest in inviting us to come provide comment and have dialogue related to this issue. We appreciate and agree with the overall goal of trying to create cost-effective, high-quality emergency care throughout the Commonwealth. Emergency physicians are a disparate group. We have common things that bind us, but we practice in many different environments, rural, state borders, inner city, different type of insurance populations that we serve. Some are in large uninsured areas, underinsured areas. We work in all different settings. We provide care 24/7, 365, even 3 in the morning when we're there, emergency physicians, weekends, nights, whether we can't shut our doors. If patients aren't coming in, we're still providing a large standby value to the Commonwealth and to the insurer and to patients that we're there, ready for strokes, ready for traumas, ready for heart attacks, providing value even if no one's walking in the door at that time. So we're different, like a lot of providers. Is something different about our specialty compared to others and compared to the issues that we're talking about today. In relation to the issues of out-of-network balance billing, the anecdotal and extremely large bills that we hear about and talk about commonly, I don't think is the experience for emergency physician services in the Commonwealth at all. These large multi-thousand dollar bills are not what we're talking about in emergency medicine. And additionally, the out-of-network balance billing, we don't think is much of an issue in the Commonwealth, and we'll get into that in just a bit. But we don't think in emergency medicine that that's a big issue related to out-of-network balance billing. That becomes a patient responsibility. in the issue, in the idea of balance and transparency, one of the issues that comes up in emergency medicine and in all specialties is we don't know in emergency medicine what the deductible is, what the copay is, if they're in network. We're prohibited by law to even inquire about such things. We are there to serve as a safety net. And part of the balance and transparency thing that we're looking at is we need to support emergency services to be able to recruit and train and retain physicians throughout the Commonwealth. Every hospital, every emergency department will have its own challenges, either geography or population, payer mix, to recruit and retain physicians to serve the emergency medicine community. Getting patients in the middle as it relates to balanced billing and surprise coverage. Let's talk about surprise coverage, maybe a little bit, maybe a one way to think of things as opposed to surprise billing. Patients are surprised that they don't have coverage. One way that this commission looks at the efficiency of care delivery, the waste in the healthcare system, and physicians, emergency physicians not being able to focus on patient care and focusing on more administrative duties is the large deductibles and plans that are putting increasing patient responsibility. That is surprising patients when they find these large responsibilities. Additionally, if a patient comes to the emergency department and they have chest pain, I don't know whether they've reached their deductible, they haven't reached their deductible, if they're insured or uninsured. But ultimately, providers, emergency physicians, need to go after patients for that portion of their bill. That's their responsibility. That may be a big portion. I suggest one way for administrative simplification, streamlining of the healthcare system in Massachusetts would be to make the deductible portion something that the insurance company would deal with. In order to have transparency of payment and coverage, it would be nice to know when you contract that you will get paid for that amount and not have to go through becoming billing experts and billing patients directly. Providers, if they're contracting, should be getting that directly from insurers of payment, and then the deductible issue can work out between the patient and the insurance company. So I think that's one area to look at for simplification. We don't think that there is a large out-of-network balance billing issue for emergency medicine. We're not here to support large outlier charges and payments. We don't think that this is an issue. And the idea the gentleman had asked, well, what if we set something tied to contracted rates, either the maximum someplace else or something with you? The notion of a fair payment, I think, is what the balance question was. I had heard a question earlier, what is this balance? What is this balance that we're referring to? In order to maintain the safety net of emergency, qualified emergency physician providers that are there nights, weekends, they have families, it's a lot to retain high quality and maintain high quality care in this Commonwealth. We need to make sure that there's an ability to get fair payment. What that exactly means is open to discussion. What is the fair payment rate? But one thing that it isn't is creating a situation where we tie it to a contracted rate today, which then tomorrow and next year and the year after then starts to be the contracted rate. There's no leverage. There's no real market. And you put the situation where what we think today might be a fair contracted rate, to the gentleman's comment, can't we tie it to something to do with current contracts? If we do that, then we really will make it so that we make the safety net very vulnerable. Mr. Burdick will comment on maybe some specific legislation that's being considered by the commission.
Thank you for having me here, and we'd be welcome to submit comments afterwards. We didn't know exactly what your focus would be, so we deferred on preparing written comments till afterwards. A couple of things to focus on that I would like to address directly, since it looks like the ED side's got the bullseye on their back today. And several things. One is setting the reasonable value of services to a contracted rate, I think, is in cursory concept, a palatable idea. I think in reality, it just doesn't work. And the reason for that is multiple fold. If you just look at the situation of who determines that rate,
is it, how do you monitor that rate? Providers never have the opportunity to monitor that rate because the payers don't provide us with that information. We can't get that information. So the providers would need to rely upon the payer submission of, or certification that that is the reasonable rate. Is it the reasonable rate, the highest rate in the Commonwealth, the lowest rate in the Commonwealth? And regardless of what that is, what it does ultimately is empowers payers to say, we can continually reduce the cost for emergency services by continuing to lessen the rates that we're going to pay on the contract itself. It just doesn't make sense. To Dr. Burke's point, I don't think you have a problem in Massachusetts. You have a current law on the PPO side that provides for what the rate should be. If you want to address what it should be for the rest of the product lines on the HMO side, the indemnity side, it seems to me all you need to do is expand the PPO law to the other areas. Regardless of, even if you do that, you're not going to cover ERISA. So what do you do with that? Additionally, to the idea that you have to have a balanced approach, it's not too complicated. All I beg to differ, it is complicated. The New York law is a disaster. I have the benefit of having emergency room physicians that we're representing. I just made a list as Dr. Berg was talking. Florida, Tennessee, Kentucky, Connecticut, Georgia, Oregon, Washington, Illinois, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Massachusetts. And I can tell you the problem with the New York law is multifaceted, and the briefing that you submitted is inaccurate in a number of statements. So I think if you want to take a look at New York law, you need to take a balanced look at it. How is it playing out? How do you set that benchmark? I have concerns with a benchmark that is populated by payer data only, that is completely unable to be monitored on the provider side. You also have a law in Massachusetts that precludes physicians from not balance billing their patients. So how do you address that? You're going to have laws that are inconsistent with one another, a law that says you can't balance bill, and a law that says you do need to balance bill. But I think there are a number of areas. Let me stop because I'm sure there will be a question or two, and I don't want to be excessive with our time.
Thank you.
If you could take a moment in saying that the New York law is a disaster, could you just comment a little bit further on how it's a disaster and to whom?
Well, I think one of the misnomers is there is a prohibition against balance billing. That's just not true. There's a prohibition against balance billing for claims that fall within the IDR process. Claims that fall under that are not prohibited from being balance billed. If we're determining a claim that is subject to the IDR process, you have a twofold step. One, 120% of the usual and customary rate that is undefined and is at this point tied to the Fair Health database, which I think everybody would agree has many faults, including the people in New York that created it. The other is that it has to be over a benchmark of on the CPT code, and I think it's right now around $600. So there's trouble calculating what that is. The next idea is that I think in your briefing you indicated that there would be a reasonable payment made by the insurance company. That's not what happens. What happens is if a bill is submitted, the insurance company can either pay the bill that's submitted or determine what it deems reasonable. Those are the two options. Once that's determined, if one of those two payments are made, there's nothing else. The provider then has the opportunity to accept that payment or it can appeal through the IDR process. If it appeals through the IDR process, the claims that I've monitored, the provider has not yet prevailed on one of those claims. And the provider then has to pay the IDR fee of $350 per IDR hearing. A very cumbersome process. The patient isn't aware of what to do. They're getting the EOBs that have an adjudication code. Your patients have been paid in full. They don't understand why the physician is still seeking greater reimbursement. It is not the transparent system you would like.
I would echo to the comments that I made about looking for opportunity for simplification. The New York situation is in the goal of trying to simplify things and make payments transparent and the process transparent. The rush to model after New York, I think, is an open question as to how that legislation is playing out. Even some of the ambiguities as to how it's written right now, what is the $600 cap, $637 that it is now, Is that a CPT code or is that the entire bill? It is administratively burdensome. I know that there was some comment by the commission looking at Connecticut, which might be a bit of a more streamlined process. And again, I'll go back to the deductibles and the transparency for both the providers and the patients, that perhaps we should get doctors out of the business of being in the middle of that.
I want to ask you a question. We were told by MAP that one of the emergency physician groups for which they have at least some of their members have a good deal of difficulty with out-of-network bills is Merrimack Valley Emergency Associates. My looking on the Merrimack Valley Emergency Associates website and the Lowell General Hospital website, I can't find a single instance where it says anything about whether the emergency physicians are in-network or out-of-network. So even if I were having an emergency and I wanted to know if I went there, would it be in-network or out? At least on my first pass, I can't find any evidence of that. Is that right?
And as a patient, would the patient, if the reasonable payment, I can't speak to that specific issue, but from a patient's perspective, would they have coverage for that service as long as the charge was reasonable?
I don't know. We're just told by MAP that they have a lot of difficulty with out-of-network billing at that for that particular physician group.
Right,
and there's nothing at all on the website that I could find. It may be there, and I couldn't find it. There's nothing on either website that I could find that would let a consumer know about that.
And I don't know, and I apologize, if the hospital's a tax-exempt hospital, there are new regulations out there, 504C, 504R, that require certain posting, 501R, I believe. So if you're asking, are the physicians prospectively going out and canvassing the community to inform them that if you do come to the facility, we are non-contracted, I would think that is highly unlikely, and I would think
But the whole disclosure thing is just not working. Let's just be clear that that's not working at all.
If a group can't contract with a payer because they haven't been able to reach a negotiation, and the payer and the current laws in the Commonwealth are protecting the patients.
They're not. The current laws are not protecting the patient.
How?
Because they can get an out-of-network bill when the doc's out-of-network for as much as the doc wants.
We have protection. That's not true.
There's no limit on what the doc can charge them out of network.
What the doctor, but are we seeing any evidence that there are these charges that are in that particular?
Well, we're told by MAP that particularly for that and a few other groups, that that's a big deal.
That patients are being balanced both out of network charges. Are we hearing from patients about that?
That's what we're being told.
We heard from patients
about that. We're hearing from MAP, from the insurers about it.
Or emergency services?
Yes.
And I guess I would add two comments. One, that's the insurer's obligation. They're the one that has the contract. They're the ones that are taking the premium. They have the obligation to inform their customers of what the coverage is and where it is. Secondly, I would like to see information to see if it is indeed a out-of-network service and it's a PPO service, then the payer does not have to pay unreasonable rates. So why is the payer unilaterally doing so? Why is the payer putting themselves in that position?
And the solution, I don't think, with all due respect, some of the examples that we've all read about and heard about that are outlier charges, not here to defend. We're talking about emergency medicine, and I come as an emergency physician, and I don't believe that this issue of these outlier charges are in actuality an issue for emergency medicine providers throughout the state. Happy to continue a dialogue. But the solution, if there was an anecdote, the solution of saying that we're going to now tie you to a contracted rate, however that's defined and however non-transparent that is, and the implications of that in terms of talking about the earlier question related to balance, is it will make it where emergency physicians don't have any actual contracting ability, that there is no actual fair, non-coercive contracting. And we know what the result of that will be. And that will seriously threaten the ability to provide emergency services. I'm happy to talk about that.
We're going to have to make that the last point. We still have two other panels to get through, but thank you.
Thank you for your time.
We now have the Mass Society of Pathologists, Dr. William Casimir.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me to speak. I'm William Kasmer. I'm the president of the Massachusetts Society of Pathologists. I'm also the chief of pathology at South Shore Hospital, as well as the president of Metro South Pathology, which is my pathology group. I'm somewhat surprised that the issue of out-of-network billing is an issue for the committee, because in 27 years of practice in two different institutions, I do not remember this ever coming up in my practice. Both hospitals where I practice have stipulations in my contract that I will participate with whatever plans the hospital participates with when asked. And not only am I rarely asked, but I've never received a complaint from the hospital or from a patient about this. And my billing company informs me every time there is a dispute about a bill. I'm also surprised that laboratory and pathology have been mentioned as big ticket items in terms of out-of-network billing, based on my own experience. I can only surmise that some of this out-of-network billing relates to specialized testing, which is sent to reference labs, most of which are out of state. A lot of this testing is molecular testing and genetic testing for specific malignancies, and that testing is required to determine whether patients are going to respond to that chemotherapy or not. Those chemotherapeutic agents are indeed expensive. They are an order of magnitude more expensive than the testing required to see whether they'll be efficacious or not. So as others have stated, I think that a great deal more data is needed, particularly on the pathology side, and the more granular that data is, the better we are. I frequently get complaints from physicians that my reports are too slow, general comments like that. And when I ask them for specifics, I find out, well, there's a good reason why that happened. And I think we're dealing with the same thing here. I think that we have specifics about what specific tests are an issue, what specific providers are an issue, we will be able to solve the problem. I also don't think that narrow networks serve patients particularly well. I speak as both as a patient and as a physician. It may severely limit their access to specialists, particularly those patients with rare and serious conditions. And rather than looking at who's participating and who's not participating, payers should be concentrating their efforts on finding hospitals and providers whose practices are most cost-efficient. They may not be the least expensive, but they do provide the greatest value to their patients. I'll be happy to take any questions.
We were told there were two pathology groups in Massachusetts for which out-of-network services, out-of-network bills are some issue for some set of patients. Those are Pathology Associates of Norwood and Western Math Pathology Service. Those came from MAP. You should probably talk with MAP about what's going on with them, because they believe there is a problem in pathology.
I cannot speak to every, the president of the society, but I cannot speak for every group that is within the
society. No, I understand, but you said you didn't know of it being a problem. We were told about two particular problems in Massachusetts.
Okay, I would be interested to know what specific issues they're having with
MAP. I should probably follow up with MAP about that.
Yes.
Don. Thanks a lot, Dr. Esmer. Would you be willing to articulate the goal that you would seek from the viewpoint of patients? That is, what are we on board together about in terms of protecting patients here from the viewpoint of the pathologies?
Well, I don't think patients should ever be caught unaware or be caught as in between the payers and the providers. I think this is an issue that should be between the payers and the providers, and leave the patient out.
Thanks.
Thank you. We have the Mass Ambulance Association, Sean Tyler.
Thank you. I'm not certain if I have a dubious distinction of that in cleanup, so I will equally, I will try my best to be as brief and concise and maybe a touch pedantic. Just going through the questions as they were posed, as from the Mass Ambulance Association's vantage point, there's a fairly unique set of questions, and so we're just pleased as punch to be here to try our best to offer some vantage point. First, just so in full disclosure, I'm Sean Tyler, Mass Ambulance Association, a member of the Board of Directors, also president of an ambulance operator, Fallon Ambulance Service, as well as co-chair of the Town of Abington's Finance Committee, for which I'm authorized to speak in all three. And then not only of all the above, I'm also a paramedic, so I speak with a degree of passion, so I apologize for any inadvertency that might come through. The issue or question as it relates to out-of-network and emergency services is a bit befuddling because there is indeed patient protections that already exist in statute as it relates to emergency ambulance service operators and providers. And I'm thankful that we have the Massachusetts Managed Care Reform Act that indeed holds patients harmless and does compel payers to pay the UCR that was submitted to them. Insofar as non-emergency ambulances, which is not germane to this particular discussion, that typically is the subject of a business transaction and contracted providers, as there is leverage. As we can all easily understand, instead of for me to endeavor into histrionics and say, well, geez, April 2013, we have a lot of people that we want to moving on an emergency basis because we had to provide standby service for the marathon event or the house fire that happened last night where you happen to have a mom and an infant that required emergency services as it relates to smoke inhalation. Point at hand is that you can't pre-plan someone's heart attack. You can't pre-plan the need for agency-type services. So as in every municipality who's required to provide emergency medical services, you need to understand, or at least I would hope that you would appreciate, that 24/7 we don't have emergencies happen. And if Mr. and Mrs. Blue Cross could predict and plan those MIs for me a little better, then I'm pretty confident that I could justifiably work with my colleagues at the Fire Chiefs of Mass, the PFFM, et cetera, to say how do we staff for those pre-planned MIs, but that is not the case of the work that we do. Insofar as, do you have any information regarding the extent of which patients face these out-of-network bills? It really comes down to my previous answer, which was, geez, you know, the Mass Managed Care Reform Act says that patients are held harmless, and indeed payers are going to remit payment to us. Ambulance service is a very narrow focus. We are used when called and when we are needed. In the emergency medical setting, that is typically the most vulnerable of the population, those who typically have Medicare and Medicaid, a smaller percentage of private insured, and another smaller percent are underinsured. As I mentioned earlier, the transaction with regards to non-emergency ambulance services is indeed subject to the austerity of contracting if indeed those business cases can be made and folks agree. The overwhelming majority are indeed contracted. The issue with regards to disputes, we seldom have those disputes, again, predicated on the first response as it relates to out-of-network. If this is an emergency medical services, we don't have those types of disputes. The question I thought was unique, which was, I'm going to refer to as question 7, out-of-network billing concerns impact bargaining dynamics. As I just referenced, there are no bargaining dynamics when it comes to payers and ambulance services all inclusively. We don't have the cards. I think as the commission was citing, you referenced MAP, you referenced Blue Cross Blue Shield, you referenced the aggregators of data sources. There seems to be a negotiation that doesn't really exist. It's take it or leave it. And in the sense of an emergency medical services provider, I don't know what the business case or compelling opportunity is to take it or leave it. I think that there's a bigger question that we can answer, which was suggestions for mitigating any such costs out of network or otherwise as it relates to billing protections. In my association, the Mass Ambulance Association, has partnered with the Mass Municipal Association, the Fire Chiefs of Massachusetts, the Professional Firefighters of Massachusetts, in legislation that we've submitted. It's been filed, and it deals with, you know, allowing municipalities their police powers to set the rates, which is what they currently do today. They do so by de facto. So whether they contract with a private ambulance provider or they have their own municipal service, which we all like stats. 251 municipally run ambulance services. You have about 20 privately run ambulance services in the Commonwealth of 351. To that end, you have protections. You have elected officials who are elected, who are held account to the rates that are charged in those municipal or emergency scenarios. Our bill does two things. One, formally places that responsibility on those elected officials. And then second, it absolutely eliminates balance billing. Fully and completely, it eliminates balance billing. I did prepare written comments just because I wasn't certain if I was going to get a chance to chat. So I have a plethora of paper here, but the turgid issue, quite honestly, of price versus cost, emergency medical services versus non. I have to tell you, when the phone rings at 3 o'clock in the morning, I'm going to be there 6 minutes or less based on the request for services that you asked for. I'm going to take a patient to the closest appropriate facility per statute that says that's exactly what I need to do for the services and care that that patient provides. As a member of the patient care continuum, my job, frankly, is to minimize what any threat to life, limb, and safety, and to actually get that patient to a place where they can ease their suffering and hopefully get better. I can speak faster if you'd like.
Thank you.
Questions?
So your testimony was incredibly at odds with what we heard at our last meeting, where we were told time and again by the insurers that amongst the biggest problems they have are with ambulance services, including Fallon Emergency Medical Service, that there are quite a large number of cases where Fallon and other and eight other ambulance providers listed to us are not in network, and that therefore there's a very large bill submitted to patients by the ambulance service. And you, I think you just said you, that doesn't happen. So I'm wondering, is sure. MAP wrong about this?
Sure, actually. Well, so here's the context of where MAP is wrong. And I'll give you the notion, and this is the passion side of the world. They're wrong insofar as the following. So you're Mr. and Mrs. Tufts, or I'm going to make up a payer. You're Mr. and Mrs. ABC payer. I don't mind being called up by name, so I'll preserve their dignity. You're going to pay a partial payment, and you're going to say, I'm not going to pay you anymore. The patient is responsible. And in turn, the patient is obligated to get a bill, but they get a note specifically from me that says, hey, the Mass Managed Care Reform Act provides you protection, and unfortunately, I'm going to need you to contact that payer, and the payer, in turn, remits the remainder of the balance. So that does happen, and that is a very uncomfortable, inappropriate use of the way the systems and services are. Moreover, I give you another challenge, is that you have another member who's not a member of MAP, but Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts, who has instituted a payment policy that instead of an emergency medical service case, someone called 911, and you happen to have Blue Cross Blue Shield, they pay the patient directly. So they require an ambulance service to bill the patient directly. And yes, that bill is going to be whatever number it happens to be. The Blue Cross Blue Shield and their testimony, either directly to you or through the Boston Globe editorial or through anyone else, absolutely says we're going to do that. They're going to have an ambulance bill submitted to us. We're going to pay the patient directly. We're going to require the patient to be billed. So the challenge that I see back, quite honestly, is that we do have protections that exist. It's not, I can't help how folks, payers, want to respond to that. I still stand firm. 3 o'clock in the morning, I'm still going to come and help.
No, I understand that part, and I think that's a great thing about all of the emergency services that we've heard about from ambulance and radiologists and pathology and labs and anesthesia and all of that, and that's a great thing. The issue that we're interested in is how much does the patient pay for it at that time, and there's a fundamental dispute between you and MAP as to how much the patient pays for that service.
Sure. Well, actually, I don't think there's a dispute. I think the challenge here was that MAP says the patient gets billed. And I'm saying, yes, the patient gets billed.
No, MAP said the patient winds up paying a lot.
No, actually, I can tell you, if you submit data, we submit data in our cost reports to CHIA. And it's evident as to how much, what percentage of cash is paid for by patients. And that's a de minimis amount. I mean, let's talk austerity for a moment. And let's think, whenever a patient becomes the responsible payer, that represents the largest portion of bad debt. Because the patient, I can't speak for every ambulance service, but we have a passion of insurance to provide service, and we build a responsible party. And when a patient is that responsible party, we have compassionate care, and we follow health safety net. And oftentimes, based on patients' significant issues or concerns, we work with them to go after the payer. But I find it odd that we have an ostensible issue between a payer who says, do just that, bill the patient because we're not going to pay.
Sean, so in that case where Blue Cross is paying the patient and then you're billing the patient, are you billing the patient at a higher amount than what's the...
Okay. We're still not getting paid if you want to have that discussion.
This is just a fundamental factual dispute that we're witnessing.
Wendy. No, I was going to add to that. It's a factual dispute, but I understand where the two interpretations could sit. I think the question we need real clarity from you on is essentially there is no balanced billing. There are two complicated ways in which you get paid. One is Blue Cross pays the patient and then you have to bill the patient, but they are for equal amounts, correct?
That is correct.
And then the second is that an insurance company will give you a partial payment. You will balance bill the patient, but tell them that they don't need to pay it as long as they go through a somewhat complicated process. Is that correct?
Well, I wouldn't call the last. It's complicated if you're the patient because you're unknowledgeable. Yes, absolutely. The difference is, of course, is that the payer doesn't want to hear from me and refuses to hear from me. So they need to hear from their member. So that it's, and the answer to your question is yes. Me as a user of the healthcare system, a guy who has an insulin pump in my hip, I understand that complexity. And fortunately, I'm knowledgeable enough to have to fight for that. But in that MAB example, when they pay a partial piece and they're obligated to pay the full, the patient does get stuck in the middle. So the resolution, I know that the association, Mass Annual Association, has offered in our tender legislation. Equally, it seems silly that I have to continue to remind a payer of what the current statute does read and what their obligations are. And because we talk about costs, you talk about minimizing, mitigating costs, total health expense, health care expense, rather. It's interesting that there's a system that exists that says we have to build cost in order for us to comply with regulation or statute, rather. I have to add burden of expense by going through a billing process instead of actually getting aid from a patient who accepts. I accept assignment. The patient says, yes, I want you to pay these folks directly. And insurers choose not to do that. That's crazy.
So what would you like to see happen to better protect patients?
I would like, and again, this is, if I could also have a puppy dog and some ice cream, I would like for that legislation to be accepted. I would like for it to pass through conference. It creates a protection as it relates to ceilings on rates because they're set by municipalities based on their service that they're looking to choose. It assures that there is no balance billing to patients, that patients are taken out of that equation. And it equally assures that the agencies that provided the service, that provided that 911 ambulance service, receive the payment directly. I don't, personally, again, I'm impassioned because I don't find it to be a big ask.
Thank you. Commissioner, can I just quickly, thank you, Sean, for your comments. And I think, thank you for everyone who testified. I think really crystallized for me a lot of consensus around getting the patient out of the middle of this, but the issue really is what is fair and reasonable reimbursement from the insurance company to the providers for those services that were rendered, and how is that determined, and what rights do the physicians have in being able to ensure that that is a reasonable amount. I would challenge and ask everyone who's testified today to please provide us information. There are other states that have determined processes for dealing with that payment. They're outlined in a brief. Sean, you just mentioned another, you know, potential avenue, which is to say the municipality sets those rates. We are interested in hearing your thoughts on what other states are doing or other ideas about how we can ensure that there is reasonable and appropriate payment on the back end, but allow for the patient to get out of the middle of it. I think that would be something helpful to hear from everyone about in further testimony or written comment to the commission.
But there are also factual disputes here that I think we need to follow up and figure out what's going on, because we were told that there are services where patients were paid a lot, and then we were told that for those exact same services, the patients are not paying very much.
We're not paying at all.
And so I perhaps too inappropriately belittled the idea of gathering more data at the beginning, so I apologize for doing that, but it seems like we ought to be able to understand those factual issues.
So we will close the listening session, I know the Customs and Market Performance Committee is about to go into session, so thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Just because we ran over, I propose Mr. Seltz, that we continue going without any lengthy intermission.